Hare Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaveyam Karavavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavidvishavahai Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Page 69. Oh, we just on 69. Since it is obligatory for the householder to worship the demigods according to his caste, he will worship the demigods and forefathers by offering them the remnants from their Lord, Krishna. Similarly, when the devotee sees the murti of a demigod, he will pay respects to the demigod, seeing the demigod as a Vaishnava. However, the devotee will not accept the prasad remnants of an offering that a Mayavadi has made to Vishnu. Because the Mayavadi's chanting and worship are both offensive, the Lord never accepts his offering. Right? So here it's mentioning it's obligatory that the householder is worshipping the demigods. Right? That's just his duty, because he's getting so many benefits from the demigods. Right? The brahmachari, his results of his work aren't for himself, so he's not obliged to worship the demigods. But the grihastha is of the sense of ownership, that this is mine, my house, my family, my money. You know, I have that independent, I have the, you know, independent responsibility to take care of these things. Therefore, then he has a debt to those who provide it. Right? So the demigods, they're managing all these kind of things. So he's obliged to. It's not a matter of, oh, you know, it doesn't matter, I don't feel like it, or, oh, that's stupid, or, you know, all these different angles. But he's obliged to worship the demigods. But because he's a devotee, then that's done by in connection with Krishna. So any obligation there is by they get the remnants of prasad offered to the Lord. Does that make sense? So generally speaking, for those who are not coming from a background that has a tradition in this deity worship, then there's no, deva worship, then there's no problem. Like you see in Rajasthan, then they have their festivals, they're worshiping Devi. Some others worship Shiva, some others worship Ganesh, some like this. So it's just part of their family tradition. But in there, then they'll offer all the, they'll worship Vishnu, the remnants from that worship, they'll offer to the demigod. Then there's not a problem. Right? But it's not that if you don't have the tradition that you'd start one. Right? Because if you're worshiping Krishna, there's no need to worship him. But it says here, according to his caste. So, therefore, if there's going to be a difficulty, because in that community they're worshiping this particular demigod, then he does it by offering the remnants of the foodstuffs. Does that make sense? You know? So, just like you see in Prabhupada's, that whole big family, right, the Mullah family, then they worship Radha Govinda. They had Radha Govinda. They also had, I think, Revati and Balaram. And they also had a Durga deity. Right? The Durga deity would move around. So the remnants from Radha Govinda would be offered to Durga. Like that. So it's just part of the word. It's been there in the family who knows how long. Because it's one thing, if the family was always Vaishnavs, then there generally won't be such a, tradition of demigod worship. But if they become Vaishnavas, then many times there is. And so part of the family will appreciate, part won't. So one just is worshipping. Does this make sense? Right? But if one doesn't have a tradition, it's not like traditionally in your family, always in your family since, you know, back before the American Revolution, that your family, you know, situated there in Massachusetts, always worshipped this demigod, you know, like that, then, you know, that's another thing. But if they weren't, then there's no need to start. Right? Does that make sense? You know, under the table, no one knew it. But, you know, in your family for the last 4,000 years, you know, they've been worshiping some of those deities from Baal, you know, like that. You know, but you don't worry about it, you know, like that. You just offer them prasad from worshiping Vishnu, right, like that. But if it's not been like that, does that make sense? You know, you're not, you know, the Egypt connection, so you've been worshiping Ra, you know, anything's like that. Does that make sense? So, in other words, it's not necessary. Right? If they're obliged to worship the demigods, but if you worship Krishna, then that obligation is not there. Right? But that means that whatever you're doing, that means all the standards of worship of Krishna, that's not dropped. Just because we drop for the demigods doesn't mean that we drop now for Krishna also. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Prabhupada's making this point because maybe from our backgrounds it's not such a big deal, but if you preach in environments where they do have a tradition, right, then you know what to say. You know how to deal with it. Does that make sense? You know, so it's the standard. Like that. So not that, yes.
How do you deal with, if you preach in India, there are really all kinds of, you know, Lakshmi and Yoga and Kali and whatever, everybody is there.
You first have to make them understand when they're worshipping all the varieties of demigods. First thing is to understand by worshipping Krishna, you're worshipping all of them. So if it's just a matter of their own taste, right, then that is unnecessary. You know, they have, you know, 20 pictures there. It's unnecessary. It's not a tradition in the family or this or that. But if it happens to be, then they offer prasad from Vishnu. They worship Krishna and then offer that remnants to them. Because then they're devotees, so you're worshiping them in that way. Then they just put them on the lower steps, you know? Like that. But the point is it's not necessary, because when you're worshiping Krishna, See, there's a difference between want and tradition. You know what I'm saying? It's like they've had this deity in the family for generations and stuff like that. That's one thing. But this is just they like, so then they put these pictures on. Maybe their parents put it there, but where did that come from? Because Krishna sets a standard. He asks Nanda Baba, why are you doing this? He says, we've always done this. You know, worshipped Indra. But there's no need to worship Indra here. Right? So they're worshipping Govardhan Hill. If they wanted to worship, then you worship Govardhan and offer the remnants to Indra. Right? But in this case, you know, because Indra is getting out of line, Krishna wanted to protect. So the point is there's no need to worship the demigods. But if they offer the remnants of prasad like that, it says according to their caste. So the different castes have different deities that they're worshipping. Does that make sense? Just historically, that you know, a particular group worships a particular deva. Does that make sense? Like that. So then it's not a problem. But this thing where they have 20, 30 pictures, that's not so necessary. That's just because they want money, they want this, they want that. All that's going to come from Krishna. So if they're obliged to worship a particular demigod because of their family tradition, then that can be done by offering the prasad to Krishna. But if you're worshiping, you know, Lakshmi to get money and Ganesh to worship this, and does that make sense? Then that is not necessary. There's a distinction being made here. Does that make sense? But in the beginning, if it's just they're just taking up Krishna consciousness, make them very clear how Krishna is the main is sent. By worshipping him, everyone else is worshipped. So worship him and offer the remnants, because they're all devotees of Krishna, to them. And that way they'll become purified. And then with time you see if it's, you know, necessary. Is that right? Yeah. Yes.
Is it true that inside the body of the cow, all the demigods are residing?
In the body of the cow, all the demigods reside, yes. They're all represented in the cow.
So when a person respect cow, worship cow,
he gets the benefit of worshiping all the 33 million demigods. Yeah, you could probably look at it that way. So then you could always... Because they'll generally go for that. The Hindus will go for that. Okay, if you could worship all the demigods that are worshiping the cow, then it probably would work. Yes.
Neophyte is suggested in initial stage to worship demigods.
Neophyte is suggested? Who said that?
Like
no, but who's suggesting? You're saying neophyte is suggested. Who's suggesting?
I heard in lecture that Krishna should be worshipped.
Yes.
Main worship should be done to Krishna. And with obeisances, respect should be paid to all demigods. And afterwards, one should completely leave demigods and
then. So you're saying that the neophyte should take up the demigod worship?
Krishna should be worshipped. Main Krishna should be worshipped.
Yeah. Now, where does the demigods come into it? Why are there demigods there? What's the situation? No, this is a question. It generally gets a response as an answer.
One should be worshipping Ganesha to remove all obstacles and devotee service.
No, but the point is how are... But I mean, in any case, that's one person.
Would Shiva help those in the mood of ignorance?
Uma helps you get a good, you know, good wife also. Yes. I mean, what's the situation? You know what I'm saying? In other words, we hear some things... And we take, you know, connect, you know, one to one, and then something over here at the 57. You know, that process is not going to be very valuable. Because you're presenting it that the neophyte devotee should worship the demigods. That is not said anywhere. It says obligatory for the householder, not for the neophyte, unless you're equating householders with neophytes. And if you do that, then you might have a little trouble after the class. You know what I'm saying? So the point is that we're trying to distinguish here is that one is worshiping Krishna, giving up all other sorts of worship. Does that make sense? But we're trying to point out that the process of worship is not to be given up. To try to follow that direction. Because devotees can tend to do that. Oh, we don't get into all this ritual because smartas are bad. So then regular pancharatric ritual of worshipping the deity, oh, we don't care about all that. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So we're trying to define between your worshipping Krishna according to the directions of the acharyas. And demigod worship is given up because you don't worship anyone else other than Krishna. But if you have a family tradition where there's some specific demigod or demigods that are worshipped by tradition, then you offer them the remnants from the worship of Vishnu. You know what I'm saying? So basically speaking, that will only apply in traditional Indian families. Notice I used the word traditional. I didn't say Indian families. Because nowadays, most Indian families don't have a tradition. Does that make sense? You know what I'm saying? You know, I mean, going to McDonald's and Pizza Hut, that's new. That's not a tradition. You know, like that. If you're from New York, maybe it's a tradition. You know what I'm saying?
At the back side of ISKCON temple, I've seen Maharaj like picture of Ganesha.
No, but what's the point? What's your point?
Krishna alone can remove all obstacles.
Yes, so therefore there's no need. If others are doing it, what do you care? You know, I mean, there's people in India. You had, you know, when they had a problem with the reservations, then 130, you know, college students burned themselves. So now you're going to go do that, right? I mean, what was that guy who was just in Delhi? He was fasting for all this and that, you know. So you were fasting? Yes? No? No, so the point is you do what you're supposed to do and don't worry if anybody else is doing or not doing. Does that make sense? So all we're trying to establish here is that worship of anyone else other than Krishna is giving up, but the process of worship of Krishna is not given up. And if you have an obligatory worship of a deity, then that can continue by worshiping by worshiping Krishna and offering the remnants, right? And any demigods one comes across, then one offers respects as devotees of the Lord, right? But the Mayavadis who are worshiping Vishnu, the remnants from that worship, and the Mayavadis who are worshiping these demigods, or anybody else who's worshiping the demigods and materialists, we don't accept those remnants. Because their offering is not, to Vishnu is not accepted, and to the demigods it's materialistic, so therefore it's not, it doesn't have any spiritual value. Is that clear? Also, to accept offerings made directly to the demigods is an offense to Vishnu and obstructs the path of pure devotional service. So we may say Ganesha as a devotee, but the guy who's offering to the worship of Ganesh is not necessarily. Does that make sense? Yes.
Does that mean that when we visit the Ganesh temple or some other temple, can we take the prasadam, the remnants?
No. No, we don't. Because the people who are offering it aren't. See, if you had devotees doing the worship and they were worshiping Vishnu and offering the remnants to the demigod, then that's fine because Vishnu is prasad. But here you have a materialist worshiping the demigod, and so Krishna's not involved at all, so we don't, it's not technically prasad. They call it prasad, but, you know, because what else are you going to call it? You know what I'm saying? But it's not actually prasad. Yes?
Maharaj, did you mention in your previous lecture that when one worships a demigod, the other demigods get offended because it's like you're worshipping a demigod, but
it would be just like, let's say, you have a room full of ministers, and you go up to one and give a garland and give gifts and ignore all the other ministers in the room. What are they going to think? Right? So you can say, no, but it's just I, me, and that demigod. But the point is, you know, there's a demigod that, you know, controls your sight. There's a demigod that controls the blinking of your eyes. There's a demigod that controls your eyelashes. You know, the eyelashes stay there, fall out, or fall out and get in your eye. That's controlled by a demigod. You know what I'm saying? So everything, 33 million demigods control the universe. Right? So at least a few million are dealing with you. You know? Okay, the particular lifestyle and pattern and environment of the tsetse fly in Central Africa, maybe you don't have much to do with. So those demigods, then you're not connected much, right? Is that okay? You know, probably also aardvarks, warthogs, you know, like that.
So we have one more question that I feel about accepting demigod prasadam. Because I'm reaching quite a lot in Maharashtra, and when the devotees or new devotees, they invite me to their houses, and they have their worship only demigods. Very often there's not Krishna on the altar. But they want to give you something. They want to offer you something.
But then you offer it. You tell them that we only take Krishna Prasad, and so therefore you'll make the offering. Like that. Because, see, if you're dealing with Hindus, they can't complain that someone who's leading a saintly lifestyle doesn't take food from their house because they're materialists, especially if they're not Brahmins. That's pretty standard, you know. And even if you're eating at their house, that you would eat, you know, grains, that's also a stretch. Because generally speaking, they can only offer fruit and milk, sweets like that to you know, milk. It has to be fruit and milk, and that's all they can offer to saintly people. So that's standard. That's not, no one will argue with that. And if it's grains, generally it has to be something that's fried. You know, they can't give rice, they have to give like puris or stuff like that. This is just because it doesn't carry the karma. So you just say is that, you know, they want to say like that, and you say, if you make the offering, then you'll eat. But if they made the offering, the demigod, we don't eat the demigod prasad. You just tell them. Because the point is they want to feed you. So for them, it's more important to feed you than the worship of their demigods. So therefore, that's how you can get them to change. The point is that why, if their devotees are not worshiping Krishna, right? They want to offer the remnants then to the demigods, they can do that, but they have to worship Krishna. So that's just how you can preach, you know? Because they have to feed you. Right? But it's not that we have to eat whatever they give us. No, they have to eat what's appropriate. You know what I'm saying? You know, and one can say, no, but that's all they can do. They don't feed their dog regular stuff. They feed the dog some other thing. They feed the cow a different thing. You know what I'm saying? The cat a different thing again. Does that make sense? So the point is they're making arrangements. You know, you know, Uncle Rajesh, you know, he likes his dal, you know, without so much salt and that. And the other one over here, he takes extra ghee on his chapatis. And that one over there, then, you know, he wants a little extra chili, you know, in the sabji. And this one over there has to have a little lemon or they can't eat. And the other guy over there without yogurt, he freaks out. He's been in Madras too long, right? You know, he's living in North, but hey, he picked up the habit down there. What can we do? So that's what they're doing in every house. Nobody eats the exact same in a Hindu house. No? Yeah. So therefore, then if they want you to eat, it has to be according to how you eat. And as a sadhu, you don't eat demigod remnants. It's just the way it is. You know, in other words, the knife cuts both ways. So, you know, the Hindu this way, it also, you can use it back that way. Does that make sense? So in that way, you can get everyone in the area where you're preaching to start worshiping Krishna because they want to feed the sadhus, so the sadhus won't eat demigod remnants, so that's the way it goes. So then they have to worship Krishna. Does that make sense? Because the point is real demigod worship means you have to worship the Vishnu Shaligram first. Even in like Kali Ghat and these big, big, big temples like that, they worship Shaligram and offer the remnants. But because they're Mayavadis, Vishnu doesn't accept the prasad. Therefore, the remnants offered to the demigod also is unacceptable to the devotees. Does that make sense? But the point is they do, if you go and you see a very big Pakka temples like this, they have a Shaligram. It's just what Shastra says. It's what in the Vedas, the Upasana Kanda of the Vedas, that's just the way it works. Does that make sense? So they can't argue. There's no question of arguing. Like that. Because otherwise you can say if they want to feed you, then they bring the stuff, you'll offer it. You know? Like that. So, yes?
So actually there is no instruction in Shastra like for separate worship of the demigods.
There's no such thing. People devise that because they want something. As Prabhu mentioned, you get all these different benefits from these different demigods. So they want that benefit. That's why they worship that particular demigod. But the demigods are a class. They go together. So if you only worship one and not the other, then there's a problem. So you have to worship all 33 million. So that's going to be tough. So the only way to do that is by worship of Vishnu. Yes.
Also, in our mind, it's heavily weighted towards Guru. And so the neophytes, they rely on Guru for help to connect with Krishna. And also the advanced Vaishnavas are the abode of the demigods also.
Yeah. But by worshipping Krishna, the real devotee will give the demigods the Lord's prasad out of respect. It's just respect as devotees. It's not a worship. That's why he says it's out of respect, not out of the process of worship. Such worship and receiving such prasad is not offensive. In this way, the devotee avoids the second offense in chanting the name. And by continuing this process correctly, he achieves love of God. Right? So the second offense goes a little farther than we're thinking. Right? If by accident one should happen to turn from accepting Vishnu as supreme, one should be repentant and take shelter of Vishnu, and be careful not to commit the offense again. By remembering Krishna, by remembering his name and chanting his name, the offense will disappear. According to the Vedic literature, there is no prayaschitta, reformatory process or atonement more effective than this. Because the Lord is an ocean of mercy and an ocean of forgiveness. Similarly, the devotee also forgives past faults. Right? So that means there is no other atonement. So though it's a different topic, it's being brought up as that connection. If one does get distracted by the demigods, then one understands that this is wrong. One takes shelter of Vishnu. And the only prayaschitta is remembering the name, form, qualities, pastime, the chanting the holy name. There is no other reformatory process. We like to create them, but that's the point. It's the conditioned soul either follows religion or will create religion. They can't function without it. Right? So the point is there is no other. That's the sixth canto is the evidence of this. You have Ajamil, you know. So we just think, you know, he's a bad guy, but he's from a Brahmin family. He's just married. He has a young wife. He has dependent parents. He leaves all that for a prostitute. That's his position of Ajamil, right? And then this pastime, you know, with Narayan, his son, happens when Narayan was born when he was 88. Right, so for Narayan to be big enough to actually recognize a name and come, then he's going to be a little older than that. Right, and that means he's still with that prostitute. So you could at least give him the credit. Well, he did stay with the one prostitute like that. So, but yeah, you get the idea. You're not sure if it's not clear if she's like now he's. They're connected, or the living de facto, or she still does her business, but he gets his time, or, you know, it's not really clear, because you could have any of that, like that. Because Shastra mentions you can have a prostitute, and then if the relationship is strong, then she can become the wife, she'll give up that, you know, so, but you might find someone who has like that, so that's there, but in any case, he's left this whole background and stuff. So Ajamil, the word, from what I understand, it means that which hasn't happened before and will never happen again. That's what the word Ajamil means. So it's very extreme and very unique. So, and the only prayaschitta is chanting the Lord's name. So one should get an indication from there that there is no prayaschitta in the Vaishnava process. Yes. Repentance. Just repent that's not what you should be doing. You should be worshiping the Lord. Because you're seeing the Lord, you're seeing yourself, and you're seeing the material energy. So when you've done something wrong, it means that you're not seeing Him in the proper balance or at all. Right? So repentance doesn't mean that, you know, I'm so disgusting, I'm so lowly, I'm so this, and whipping yourself and stuff like that. That's not the process. The process is that you see that, you know, it's unfortunate that I've made that misunderstanding is there, and you're going to be fixed in having the right understanding. Because one has to be very careful, because there's actual repentance, which means it's established in, you know, goodness, pure goodness, where one sees by knowledge the actual situation and feels that it's unfortunate that wasn't acting or is not acting in the proper way, and one makes a determination to try to work in the proper way. Does that make sense? It's another thing where one identifies with the inappropriate situation or activity, And then identifying with that, then you're saying, oh, I'm so this, I'm so that, because I'm this. That's the mode of ignorance. But unless one is making the distinction, generally the mode of ignorance one is considered quite noble. But it's basically, it's nice that they're repentant, but unless, how are they going to get through it? Okay, that he felt bad. See, in a culture where if you feel good, everything's all right, and you felt like it, that's why you should do it. Or they felt like this, that's why he did it. So it's all, everything's okay. So that means that if I feel repentant, then now everything's all right. You don't actually have to correct it. You know what I'm saying? So one has to be very careful that in a culture where it's all about the feeling, and the feeling isn't bhava, you know, the feeling is mundane sentiment, then how are they going to change without an identity? Right? It means you can only change if the identity is such that, oh, I'm the spirit soul, so I'm not the body. So technically speaking, I'm not that sinful living entity. Right? The sinfulness is that I'm not thinking of Krishna. But anything else performed with the gross or subtle body, technically it's the element of sin is because there's no Krishna consciousness. So that's not me, so I can therefore be engaged in Krishna consciousness. So giving up of these of inappropriate activities, then that is based on proper understanding and therefore proper endeavor. Does that make sense? So there's a difference. Like that. One's you know, in knowledge and one's in ignorance. Does that make sense? So it's important to be able to tell the difference. Because otherwise, in the modern culture, you can't tell the difference, really. You know, it says, similarly, the devotee also forgives past faults. So the Lord forgives, the devotee forgives. Haridas concluded, one should avoid association with those who worship demigods as supreme and rather worship the Vaishnavas, who take Krishna as the supreme. In this way, one can avoid the second offense, right? So worship the Vaishnavas there, supreme. So point of, you know, guru and the Vaishnavas. Because technically it's. Three, disregarding the guru. Having wandered from one body to another in 8,400,000 species of life, through unintentional pious activity, the jiva obtains a human body. The human body is a rare opportunity because only in this form can the living entity, you know, go to the disco. Right? Isn't it? You know, he can drive around a fancy car. He can have a nice house. He can have, you know, he can do all these things. He can go to Harvard. You know, he can do all those different things. Because he wouldn't be able to do that in another species, right? So, isn't that the rare opportunity? No? So we should stick to the original here, you think? Okay. The human body is a rare opportunity because only in this form can the living entity perform devotional service properly. Just funny on that. You know, we're used to what should come out and then what? I remember once I was with Pancha Devita. It was just two of us, you know, so... You know, he's the Swami, we're the Brahmachari, so he gives the classes and we're the audience, so it's just the two of us, right? So he's giving class and he's falling asleep. So he's saying something, and I don't remember exactly, but he's talking about how Krishna is the supreme or something like this, or, you know, and the demigods, it's one of those things. And as he's falling asleep, instead of saying, you know, Krishna or something, he says the demigod or something like that. You know, he says Shiva or something. And then, in his kind of subconscious, he catches that, and then he wakes up and like, who said that? You know, that's my bad philosophy. That's nonsense. You know, and then he figured out it was him, and then he started laughing. So it's quite funny how, you know, you get so, you know, trained that even when you're, you know, half asleep, you know, you catch, no, that's wrong. Okay. As a demigod, one has a tendency to enjoy, and as a lower animal, one has no capacity for knowledge, right? So being a demigod is not an advantage. Like that. Right? Nala Kuvera, Mani Griva, good examples, right? Indra, good examples. But in the human form, the living entity can progress back to his constitutional position with Krishna. Therefore, if one does not take care to attain Krishna in this temporary body, one will die and obtain some other body, losing the opportunity to escape from the material prison. The intelligent person, having obtained a human birth in this world, will take shelter of a spiritual master who will act as a captain to guide the jiva over the ocean of material nature with the instructions of bhakti yoga. This is the importance of guru. Right? Because human life can take advantage of this. Otherwise, we see Indra as a demigod didn't necessarily take advantage of the instructions of Brihaspati and Bhrigu. And he has all the opportunity. Right? If he wanted, he could be sitting with the great sages always, but generally he's, you know, sitting in his court with, you know, Urvasi dancing and all the other apsaras. So that's the... We may complain that, you know, here it's, there's so much, you know, bad and obstacles and difficulties, but that's the point. That's why basically we joined Krishna consciousness. You know, it wasn't that everything was so fabulous and we had everything and all that, and then we noticed that I have all the money in the world. I was like talking to one person. No, I wasn't talking. I think someone else was talking. I was there. And they said, how much money do you have? And the guy said, well, let's put it this way. If I went nuts and went out and tried to buy anything and everything that I wanted to buy, when I got over it, I'd still have money left. You know, like that. So, you know, we have all the money. We have all the facility. Everything's working perfect. There's no obstacles. And we therefore then came to the conclusion that this is wrong, this is bad, this is like, you know, something's not right here. And so therefore, you know, what's the supreme, what's beyond? You understand? The general tendency is nothing goes the way you want it to go, no matter how hard you try, you know. And so therefore we're taking up Krishna consciousness. Does that make sense? So that's why he's making the point. It's not, and this is Haridas Thakur. Right, so Lord Brahma, he can speak from authority here, right? Because remember, the demigods only come to Brahma when their own endeavors don't work, right? And that's not because, you know, they're supposed to do the work. That's because of their attitude that, you know, they can take care of anything because they're so powerful, right? Like Indra, he used the club against Vritrasura when Vishnu gave him the thunderbolt. And Vritrasura then also told him, it says, you know, what kind of devotee are you? Vishnu told you to use the thunderbolt, and you use the club, because you think, in the past I defeated my enemies with the club, therefore my own prowess is the real thing. So you have more faith in your own prowess than in the instructions of Vishnu. It says, what kind of devotee are you? Now pick up the thunderbolt. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yes. Is there a chronological importance? Not necessarily, because other ones, like the 10th is considered bad, the 1st is bad, the 7th is bad. Basically, they're all bad. But, you know, there's, you know, some of them, this is the worst, this is the most abominable. I think the 7th is the most abominable, and I think the 1st is the worst. But that generally comes from the 10th. You maintain material attachment, therefore you'll get involved in sinning on the strength of the name or in committing offenses to Vaishnavas. Because when one's material attached, that means then there's ignorance, so that means there's false ego, that means then there will all be offenses. So they all are connected, but I'm not sure if there's a specific order. Because you're establishing the Vaishnavas, the preachers, what is your connection? So you've already dealt with that aspect of, here is disregarding the order of the guru. But to offend the guru, that's already taken place in the first one. You know, the guru, the Vaishnavas, the preachers. Because our connection to Krishna is through the preachers. Right? Then you have to establish Vishnu. Right? And then your connection to Vishnu is guru. Right? And then you kind of have what's in between. One who is a grihastha should accept a guru but remain in his duties of varnashrama. The Brahmana is a Krishna devotee. He can serve as guru for the Varnas. But if there's no suitable person of Brahmana birth, one can receive initiation from a guru of another Varna. If there is a choice, the Grihastha should choose the bona fide guru of higher caste. But in any case, the main qualification by which to judge who is suitable bona fide guru is how much the guru knows about Krishna. He may be Brahman or Shudra, householder or sannyasi, but this makes no difference in the guru's ability to deliver the jiva, right? So one would say, well, this is contradictory, but it's not. The point is, it's whether the guru is a Brahman or not, or whether he's a grihastha or sannyasi, that doesn't matter as far as the guru and his ability to function as a guru. The problem is our conditioning, how much we'll appreciate. Right? So grihastha is because the grihastha wants the best. Right? They have to have, you know, and no material flaws at all. Right? Therefore, then, the recommendation is only accept someone who's a Brahman. Because you'll find less material fault there. Because the Brahman will have less than you. Right? He'll have less money than you. You know, he'll have less facilities than you. You know, all these different things and that. He'll know more Shastra than you. Right? That he follows the standards of cleanliness and more than you. So then there's always these elements to respect. Because we have a tendency to look at it from the material's perspective. But in actuality, it has nothing to do with that. It's how much do they know about Krishna. How much they can give you Krishna. That's what's valuable. Does that make sense? You know, because somebody like Gorkhashore Das Babaji Maharaj sitting in a toilet, you know, the grihastha might be embarrassed, you know, to tell their friends, yeah, my Guru Maharaj sits in a toilet. Why are you sitting in a toilet? You know, my Guru Maharaj sits in a, you know, like this. You know. We would never let our Guru Maharaj sit in the toilet. We have so much more love for him. So we've made this nice arrangement. This is what you're going to hear in the grihastha society, right? So therefore, it's recommended you do like that. But the point is it doesn't matter the background, because if they know Krishna, then that's what's perfect. Does this make sense? This should be the main consideration in choosing a guru. If one desires to progress to pure attraction to Krishna, right, is how much he knows about guru. About Krishna. In other words, if there is a qualified guru of high caste, there's no necessity of seeking a guru of a lower caste, right? In other words, if they're the same, so then what's the problem? But if the high caste guru is not qualified as a Krishna bhakta, one should not take diksha from him on the basis of high caste alone. One should take a qualified guru of a lower caste. The qualification of knowing Krishna and being the devotee of Krishna is the important consideration, right? So we don't worry about it, right? You know, Rupa and Sanatan, they're from Brahmin families, but they've, you know, socially are considered in a fallen position, like that. Narottam Das Thakur, they're kayasthas, like that. So, I mean, it doesn't matter what's the background. It's what one knows about Krishna, right? But for those who are absorbed in the material environment, then they get bent out of shape that Narottam Das, how can he give initiation to those people of higher caste and all that stuff like that. So the materialistic devotees will make these complaints. You know, or the, you know, just straight materialists. Does that make sense? So that's why these considerations are there. But if you're in an environment where you don't have, that's not a problem. Right? You know, when you're dealing with, how you say, what would be the, trying to think of a nice, there are no nice. Heinz 57 doesn't work. Mongol doesn't work. Mixes of mixes doesn't give a good, you know, there's no, I say, oh, I think there's a term that the Shastra uses. Ekavarna. Yeah. When you're dealing with Ekavarna, means one Varna, which means because you can't tell what Varna it is. Like that, then it doesn't matter. So therefore, we don't have to worry about it. The qualification of knowing Krishna and being a devotee of Krishna is the important consideration. Guru may be of two types, one who gives diksha with mantra and one who gives spiritual instruction. They should be considered equal in importance by one who wants to advance quickly. Person can accept only one Diksha Guru, but may have many Siksha gurus who give Sambandha Gyan. Oh, wow, this is the spot. The Sambandha Gyan or teachings are handed down in the Sampradaya from the founder Acharya of the Sampradaya. These original teachings and the founder Acharya of the Sampradaya should be worshipped with all respect. One should be loyal to his conclusions and instructions, not taking teachings from others, right? In other words, not from anybody else who's outside of the line of the founder Acharya. One should take as Siksha Guru only a person who is following faithfully the teachings of that founder Acharya. To take initiation or teachings from a Mayavadi is useless. Right. So in this little bit here, depending upon the translation. Whose translation is this? It's Bonner. But it looks like it's been edited a bit. We'll see. It looks like it's been edited to make it more technical. You know, a little less technical. So, see, as you have the founder chart, means in this, then it's very, very important. You have, means the teachings of the Lord are transcendental. So, any instruction from someone who's bona fide is beneficial. Doesn't matter how new they are or how advanced, they'll all be useful. Right? Diksha Guru is then on the platform of Sadguru, which means that connection, there's an eternal connection, right? And the responsibility is to get one to the eternal platform, right? Does that make sense? They have the responsibility, okay? Now, in Siksha, then you're going to have three levels. Diksha, there's not three levels. There's only one class of Diksha Guru, right? But Siksha, you have three levels. You have the founder Acharya, the Adi Guru, right? This whose instructions are being followed. In other words, he sees that his responsibility is to establish instructions that are going to work for everybody in all times, all places, all circumstances. So he is preaching in a particular environment, and he has that qualification that he can establish what is appropriate, right? Like Prabhupada is the founder Acharya, and he said his instructions will be followed for the next 10,000 years. So that's the span of his founder Acharyaship, right? So they'll always be able to be used, right? Modern man has a different idea, because every 6 months his culture changes. But who cares? You know what I'm saying? The Romans thought they were pretty modern too, right? So, and where are they? So that's the point. So now, yes. So he establishes what will function over that 10,000, in this case over the 10,000 years. So that means everybody's instructions have to be in line with his instructions. If they're not, they're not useful. Right? They may be according to another founder Acharya's direction. Great. But unless one sees them in line with one's own founder Acharya, then they have no meaning. So it's not a matter of confusion. No, it's just this is the line, that's how it works. Right? It means Krishna is looking at how the line works. Krishna doesn't like people that a little bit over here and a little bit over there and like this and that. You know, it's great in the New Age, you know, community, but as far as impressing Krishna or the eternal Vaishnavas, that's not going to happen. Right? Then the second level down from that is the level of the Sadguru. So there you're going to have the Diksha Guru and Siksha Gurus who, they are also, like the Diksha Guru, taking responsibility to take you back to Godhead. Right? That's what puts them on that level. That's why we call them Sadguru. Right? Then there's a third level of the preacher, the Siksha Guru, which is the preacher. Right? So their responsibility is to give Krishna consciousness to anyone and in any situation that it will be appreciated. Does that make sense? But it's not that they're taking the responsibility to specifically take you back to Godhead. Right? Now, you may have a nice relationship with them. You may not. You know what I'm saying? You may just know them or just heard about them, but don't have a personal relationship. Or you may, but it still doesn't necessarily change that level. What changes it from preacher to sadguru is the responsibility to take you back to Godhead. Then in that case, there's no difference, right? So particularly as far as siksha goes, there's no difference than diksha. But you also have to be able to make the distinction within siksha of the three levels. That makes sense? In other words, the instruction itself is just as valuable on all three levels, right? But the responsibility is different on the three levels. Does that make sense? So in other words, the instruction may be just as good, but the relationship is not necessarily. Does that make sense? Right. So this way, then one will have so many siksha gurus. Like automatically, within the society, you have Prabhupada as the founder of Acharya, then any other senior devotees that you appreciate. Right? So that's automatically siksha guru. If you're working in a particular project or something, then the head of that project automatically is a siksha guru. Right? Because they're giving instruction, giving direction. But as soon as you move to another project, they're not responsible anymore. Does that make sense? The temple president is automatically siksha guru. But now if the temple president changes or you go to another temple, it's not that he carries on that responsibility. Right? Inherently, right? Does that make sense? There may be a personal relationship that it does, but it's not part of the job description. Does that make sense? So we see the difference here? Right. Yes.
So when you talk about the responsibility to take the disabled back to Godhead, it's
when
the Acharya is not responsible.
Who?
The Acharya. The founder
Acharya. The founder Acharya means that's why he's given instructions by following will take you back to Godhead. Yes. But the point is those instructions will take you back to Godhead, but I can give you one instruction and go away. Yes. But to see that you're following that or others that will supplement that to make sure that you progress to the point of going back to Godhead, that's the Sadguru. Like saying, you know, the senior devotee comes, you come and ask them a few questions, and then you go your way, they go their way. But the instruction is just as valuable, but the responsibility is different. Does that make sense? It means all three levels, means the founder Acharya is established, so Sadguru and the preacher, they're seeing that their instructions are in line with the founder Acharya. Does that make sense? No? Yes.
I can understand that second type of diksha guru, because I was thinking that only diksha guru is taking the responsibility to take you back home.
No, he always does, but you may have siksha gurus that are on that level. You may not. Yes. Well, see, because generally speaking, it'll work the other way. You'll come to the movement, then you'll start associating with the devotees, then you'll be attracted by, you know, various senior devotees, and with time as one goes, it matures that one becomes more prominent than the others, right? So then that person becomes the diksha guru. That's the natural course, right? But so, and then further continuing with that natural understanding is those other senior devotees, they remain as siksha gurus, right? But you do have this neophyte concept that now once I've accepted the siksha guru, I drop the relationships with all the others because otherwise it's not chaste. No. If you had more than one diksha guru, then that's a problem. But to have one diksha guru and many siksha gurus, that's not a problem. But the neophyte tends to like to think like that. It makes them feel more, you know, serious or something. But then the problem comes is if there's any problem with the diksha guru, then where do they go? right? So then their idea is just diksha, right? Until you get the Italian saying, you know, how you say, get initiated 9 times, get one free, right? You know, like that. You know, so it's like, does that make sense? So that's the problem, is because the diksha, we can see there's that direct connection, there's all things like that. The siksha is more subtle. And so what's the relationship? Like, what's the formal process for accepting a siksha guru? There isn't one. There's a formal process for diksha. Right? You know, if someone's a siksha guru, then you'll ask them spiritual questions. If they're a diksha guru, then you accept them to work out all your material problems and, you know, how to deal with the family and, you know, all these different emotional and all that. But we don't do that with siksha gurus. Interesting, right? So that's the point, is we're approaching it a bit more on the, you know, the external or sentimental concept there. You know what I'm saying? The point is the diksha guru is normally the foremost siksha guru. Right? Like that. But it's not technically that it has to be like that. But that would be normally what it is. Right? But one can have a siksha guru who is more prominent than the diksha guru. But generally speaking, it should be with the approval or the understanding of the diksha guru. Right? Because they're taking the responsibility. Does that make sense? Like that? Yes. Seems to have created more questions than answered. Yes.
why it is said that diksha guru is in the platform of Sambhajya and siksha guru is another platform of
Abhideya? Why is Diksha Guru's the Sambandha and the Siksha Guru's Abhideya? Because Siksha is for what?
For making further advancement.
And when you advance, what part of that Vastu Traya is that?
Abhideya,
yes, because that's the process. So that's Siksha. But this is where we're making the mistake. Is that the Diksha Guru is the Siksha Guru. Right? Does that make sense? So the point is the Diksha element is what connects you to Krishna. So that's why it's Sambandha. Right? So what things are the connection? You know what I'm saying? Like that. But you have to be able to discern. Let's say, you're doing something. You're offering a lamp to Krishna. Okay? So there's you, there's Krishna, and there's this lamp. Okay? Now, in the lamp, what's the Sambandha element and what's the Abhideya element?
Sambandha element is that it's in my hand, and Abhideya is that it's being offered.
And how do you define offered?
By following the rules of offering something.
Ah. So now you've defined Sambandha. Because Sambandha is you, the Lord, the lamp. What is the relationship between you and the lamp, the Lord and the lamp? Right? And it's not going to be a good title. Right? So then... And then what are the rules of how you deal with this lamp in connection with the Lord? That's all Sambandha. Right? Therefore, Hari Bhakti Vilas. Therefore, Sanatana Goswami as the Sambandha, you know, Acharya. But that you offer it with devotion, right? And you use this process as the medium for expressing that devotion. That's Abhideya. You understand? Like that. So Rupa Goswami is defining how the devotional process works, not the technicality. That's already defined in Hari Bhakti Vilas. Right? So he's defining the principles of it. What is it you're trying to get to? But that technical medium, that's the sambandha. Because that's showing how everything connects together. Does that make sense? Okay. So that means you have both of those, because Abhideya is based on, you know, the knowledge and the field. The difference is you're applying it. Sambandha simply means knowledge of it. Abhideya means, you know, application of it. So when you apply it, the difference is that it's done in devotion. Otherwise, the knowledge, unless it's applied with devotion, doesn't have any meaning. Okay? Yes.
Maharaj, some devotees, they may say that because Srila Prabhupada, he took initiation when he was a young child, and then he took again initiation from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj. That,
he took when he was a young child? What did he take when he was a young child?
I don't know. It's one devotee told me. I don't know.
Yeah, but what is it? Where is that from? I've never heard it. Anyone else heard that? Baba took initiation when he was young, and then again from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. Yeah?
Those that are trying to discredit Srila Bhaktisiddhanta bring that up. It may have been a family guru, but all credit was given to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati.
Yeah, I mean, in his books, Baba never mentions that.
Right.
Because if you have a family guru, what is the initiation of a family guru?
It's Upanayanam.
So the point is, they can't tell the difference between the Vedic samskar of Upanayanam and the Pancharatrik, you know, samskar of, they're two different things. You know, it's like you can't tell the difference between an apple and an orange. No, but they're all fruit. No, but there's a difference. Does that make sense? So in other words, they're simply trying to do all these different things because they have ulterior mundane motives. There's nothing spiritual here, because the point is Upanayanam, amongst the Gaudiyas, is not an important element. Like that. In the Gaudiya line, if someone is in a Dvija family that he gets Upanayanam, then he has it. And if he doesn't, they don't care. Right? So Prabhupada being from you know, the Vaishya background, then they generally would get Upanayanam. So if that's there, then that's normal. That's pretty standard. Right? But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur introduced it with everyone, because a Vaishnav is the perfect, you know, the matured platform of Brahminical understanding. So he wanted to at least the common person to respect the Vaishnavas as minimum a Brahmin, not try to apply all these others. You know, does that make sense? Therefore, we give Upanayanam along with the Pancharatrik Diksha. See? But it's not important. Most all these fights between the different lines are based on a total lack of understanding of the process, the various kinds of initiation, how they work, Bhagavat, Pancharatrik, and Vedic. That's why I made the point, it was yesterday or the day before, about if you don't know what initiation is, how you'll even know what reinitiation is. So that's the things most don't even, can't tell the difference between Bhagavat, Pancharatrik, and Vedic. If you tell a devotee, he says, you have three kinds of initiation, they'll go, what?
Brahman thread is
Upanayanam. It has nothing to do with the Pancharatrik. And it has nothing to do with the Bhagavat. So it's simply the Vedic. That's all. It just shows that one has accepted that samskara. That makes sense.
Pure devotee. When he comes, he can, you know, take all the conditions from back and back to water. Then, you know, he's giving, you know, he's creating opportunity. He's making so many gurus, you know, like Diksha Guru. So, is it like those who are very, very, those who are not initiated by a pure devotee, you know?
But how do you define pure devotee? How long have you been in the class? How many days have you been coming to the class?
Second.
You've only come 2 days. Oh, okay, so then you missed the whole discussion. pure devotion starts from Nishta, from the Madhyama platform. You know what I'm saying? That's what I was saying before, is that the terms Nityasiddha, pure devotee, Uttamadhikari, advanced devotee, then they're all taken as meaning one thing. Right? Someone on the platform of prema. But they're all defining the same entity, but not necessarily the same levels. Pure devotee simply means from when Krishna, the results of your activities is for Krishna and not for yourself. So the Madhyama platform is accepted as pure. So that means the Madhyam, the Bhava and Prema are all pure devotees. Uttamadhikari is Bhava and Prema. Nityasiddha is Prema. You know what I'm saying?
Those who are initiated by pure devotees, they are very, very, very fortunate.
Yes, but...
So others are means very, very much fallen than extreme.
What's the point? What's your point? It
means only very few souls are able to get initiated by pure devotees.
That's why you only have so many devotees functioning within the Gaudiya culture and all the other, you know, living entities or not. That's what I was pointing out. There's unlimited living entities. Right? And then of those, only a few are taking up the devotional process. Because when we say 33 million demigods, we're talking about the ones that have posts. We're not talking about a resident of the planet. Does that make sense? Because you have the head, then you have all the followers. You know what I'm saying? So you're talking about a lot of living entities, right? And the animal kingdom, then that's also, because that's the 4-8 million. That's the varieties. Then how many ants? Ant is one, so how many ants are there? Right? So humans are very little, and of those, very few are civilized. Civilized means follow the foreign ashram. Right? And then of those who are civilized, very few then understand, you know, how you say, the importance of Brahman, you know, and very few, of those who understand that, very few understand the Supreme Lord. And of those who accept that, it's very minimal. But what's the point? It was just a comment of that.
I just wanted to know whether, like, they are very, very fortunate, you know, those souls who are initiated by Prabhupada, by a pure devotee, and others, like, those who are not.
I wouldn't try that one. That's also bad for after the class. Prabhupada is what is talked about here as the founder Acharya. Right? One should take as a siksha guru only a person who is following faithfully the teachings of that founder Acharya. So, if the important thing of the founder Acharya, what's the important thing of the pure devotee? Just his pureness or his instruction?
Instruction.
So, the point is if you're given that instruction by someone, you know, and it's in connection with the parampara, it has potency. So if you follow it, it'll work. As a case, well, quite regularly, we point out, is most devotees are made devotees by someone who is a brand new devotee, possibly even uninitiated. Most devotees have all been made by someone like that. It's very rare anyone was made a devotee directly by Prabhupada or directly by one of our initiating gurus nowadays. Some occasionally, but more by a sannyasi, maybe by a senior man, a president, or someone else like that. But most of the people who go out on the street, you know, or sit down with the guests and talk at the Sunday feast are the brand new devotees. And they're making you a devotee. So why is that? Because the potency is there in the instruction. You know what I'm saying? The problem with the new bhakta is that today he's fired up and we're giving it, but tomorrow who knows where he is. So therefore, you accept initiation from someone who has that element of being a little more stable. Because the idea is to get the instructions of the founder Acharya in a consistent, regular fashion. Does that make sense? So it's the gaining of the instructions that are important. That's why one can have many siksha gurus, but only one diksha guru, because you only need one person to connect you. Right? Just like, let's say, you have a couple, they're going to get married, right? Okay? And now, they are, you know, since it's an imaginatory element, let's just have some fun here. Let us say they actually have respect for authority, okay? And they therefore listen to others' direction on, you know, how they as an individual and as a couple could, you know, prosper and progress in their grihastha ashram, right? Okay? Like that. So now, the person who's, you know, generally speaking would be the priest who would perform the wedding, you know, they're generally, you know, been around a while, right? Because otherwise, how do they know all these rituals and all these things? And, you know, if they're doing marriages, generally they're dealing in that environment. So they could give some advice, right? And then there's going to be others in the community who can also give advice. Right? Right? But how many people do you need to be the priest to give you, to make, to, perform the wedding ceremony that you're married? One. You don't need many. I mean, of course, if it gets every year, you could have an anniversary and do the wedding again, renew your vow, you know, all that kind of jazz. But, you know, like that, you know. And that way, then you can engage the rest of the family, because now they, you know, the daughter and son can be, you know, bridesmaids and, you know, groom. You know, you can have a good fun, right? But the point is that it's unnecessary. So you only needed one priest to connect you, but so many people can give you advice on how your marriage, you know, can be successful, right? That's what we're talking about. Right? But it's all based on the directions of the founder Acharya, meaning Srila Prabhupada. Right? One may say, no, but this means Lord Brahma. But if it does, then why are there the different lines within? Like in the Vedic line, it means there's, you know, one Brahma, he received the Vedas. Right, there's four sampradayas, but then those come down and you're in a different, you know, Gotama Shaka, you know, Bharadvaja Shaka, like this. There was 1,000 shakas, I think, in the Samaveda. There was, I think, I can't remember, 100 of this in Rig. There was all these different ones. So there's thousands of shakas. And you're supposed to stick to your shaka. You don't jump around shakas. You learn the Veda in a particular way. You stick to your line. So then it would indicate that when they're talking about being in line with the founder, they're not meaning Lord Brahma in this case. It means, of course, you're going to stick to your sampradaya. You're in the Brahma sampradaya, you're going to stick to that. But then why do we say Brahma Madhva sampradaya? Because that means there's a lot more in the Brahma sampradaya than the Madhvas. And then within the Madhvas, then there's the Gaudiyas. That means there's a lot more within the Madhvas than just the Gaudiyas. Otherwise, why we say Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya? Right? So, for us here, founder means Srila Prabhupada. Right? Right? Just like for, you know, those in the Sri line, then it's Ramanuja. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the thing. So someone in that line is following those instructions, and then it becomes perfect. Is this? Yes.
I want to ask if it's relevant, if you know some history, how the reinitiation idea came in our movement.
How does the reinitiation idea come into the movement? Basically, when gurus fell down, then there was an idea of what to do with them. You know, so naturally, the neophyte perspective, well, let's not say the neophyte, let's say the uninformed perspective is now you have no connection, you have no, all it means is now you don't have that person who is now guiding you. The loss is not the connection. The loss is the siksha. You know what I'm saying? Because we have to remember the Diksha Guru is, you know, at least if nothing else, your focal point of siksha. Does that make sense? Just like, let us say, you, as we were saying before, you have that community of devotees. And then somebody gives you, I mean, somebody performs the wedding. Okay? And then they're giving instruction, others are giving instruction. What if that priest goes away? The priest, you know, to be politically incorrect, bloops. Okay? So are you now unmarried? So it's a samskar. So you have to not know what you're talking about to say you have no connection. Because the diksha samskar of connecting you, getting your name suddenly went away, you can't remember your name, no one can remember your name. You know, you get up in the morning, everything's going, you're brushing your teeth and you're going, man, what's my name? And then you go, oh no, that means my guru blooped. You know, right? Is that how it works? So, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about this level of misunderstanding or lack of understanding. Right? What's missing is the siksha. Only the neophyte thinks it's the body that's important. It's the instructions that come from the soul residing in that body that's important, that are based on the founder Acharya. So, your relationship with the founder Acharya didn't change. Anyone in the Sri Sampradaya feels they have a relationship with Ramanujacharya. You don't have to make a resolution to state that fact. Why? Because everybody preaches that siksha is the point. And everybody, when they join, they have that. But it's not that you go back to that, it's that it was always there. The thing is when your guru falls, then you go back to probably, why did you leave in the first place? You know what I'm saying? You're dealing with a lot of real neophyte concepts here. So, that relationship is there, but the point is how are you going to understand it? We're reading. But whether we are going to understand it and apply it properly, that's why you have people responsible that you do that. So the Diksha Guru is at least there's one person responsible. But the idea is that there's Siksha Gurus also who are also supportive. Right? So, the normal course is that because you've so many senior devotees are there, let's just say, for example, so you can, you know, something to latch onto. Let's say there's six devotees that are prominent in your life that you feel are advanced and help you. So now, as time goes, one of those you choose is the Diksha Guru. Right? Now, if you do act as would be the normal cultured way, is that one now is Siksha, the other five, Diksha, one, the other five are Siksha. Life goes on. Now, if something happens to the Diksha Guru, you have five Siksha Gurus who can guide you. But if you follow the neophyte thing, is that now I've taken Diksha from this one, the other five I, you know, relegate to the dustbin, just like my relationship with Prabhupada. Then, when something happens to the Guru, you got nothing. So it's in that state of misunderstanding that the concept of reinitiation comes up. Because factually, all you need is Siksha. You're connected. But the point is the siksha aspect is not dynamic. That's what makes you advance. You advance by siksha. Because if it was the diksha that you advance by, then why wouldn't we always be having diksha? You know, we'd eternally be having an initiation ceremony going on so that everybody could advance nicely. Does that make sense? You know, when you're feeling a little down, you know, go to the temple, the initiation ceremony is going on, charge up. You understand? So, this is the reality. Because no other sampradaya has reinitiation. They just don't. You just take shelter of other senior Vaishnavas and continue. The point is that the Diksha Guru has taken responsibility to take you back to Godhead. Now you have to find a Siksha Guru who's going to take that responsibility. That's all. The position of Sadguru has to be filled. Now, Diksha's been done, but Diksha was a point in time that they connected you. But what's dynamic with the Guru is the instructions. That's what makes it work. Does that make sense? But we think it's the Diksha that... No, the Diksha is the connection. You know what I'm saying? When the guy gives the ring to the girl, what does that mean? They're connected, but what, huh?
Commitment.
So that's what the Diksha ceremony does. Because on the Bhagavat platform, there is no Diksha ceremony. Why? Because someone on the liberated platform doesn't have anything mundane to distract them. So if they decide, I'm following this person, they'll do it eternally. But the conditioned soul has a tendency not to. So now if you sat in the ceremony, and, you know, you're there, you get the name, everyone's there, and Hari Bol, and everything like that, it's going to be really hard to say that that person's not your guru. Because, you know, you've moved on, you know, like that. You know, they had a place in my life, but now I've moved on. Like that, you know, like that. You know, you can say that on Das, but, you know, you're not either, you don't. In reality, you can't say that, right? That's why Diksha is there. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So the concept comes up as a need. Now, there is some things when it's talking about reinitiation. They do mention this, but it's not in relationship to Pancharatra. It's in relationship that you have a family guru. And so they're either not a bona fide guru, so you've gotten a Pancharatra initiation from them that has no meaning. Or the family guru simply gives you Upanayanam, because in the Vedic age, that's technically enough. But when you're working with Pancharatra, then that's a step beyond. Right? Because they can't tell the difference between Dwija and Twija. Right? It means first birth, that one we understand, right? Second birth then means this is Upanayanam. Third birth is the Pancharatric initiation. Right? But if those who just follow only the Vedic, then the third will be initiation into doing those big Shrauta Yajnas and stuff like that, you know, Ashrameda and that. That's a third initiation. You understand? So this concept of Twija then is there. Prabhupada mentions it. Right? So they can't tell the difference between the two. So what Jiva Goswami and Bhaktivinoda Thakur are talking about is if you've taken initiation from a family guru and so it's not Pancharatric or it's not actually a proper Pancharatric connection, then you take initiation from someone who is. So it looks like you're getting initiated again. But they're not talking about once you've taken initiation from a bona fide representative in the Gaudiya line, and then that they go away, then you have to do that again. You know what I'm saying? But because the neophyte likes the external, therefore it's popular. But, you know, it has its disadvantages also. You know what I'm saying? So if we want emphasis more on siksha, then we have to understand there's no need. If we want the emphasis on diksha, then there's a need. But then that means if the emphasis is on diksha, then that means the emphasis is also on the grand worship of the guru. So you have to make up your mind. You can't, the same person can't say, no, you know, we're going to take this neophyte's thing, and so therefore, you know, they're going to have to take reinitiation. At the same time, the guru shouldn't be worshipped so opulently. Yeah, that's like, you know what I'm saying? It's like saying, yeah, it's like, you know, like that. No, we're going to eat bread, but you can't slice it. You know? Because that's too refined, you know, you just have to break off big chunks, and, you know. It's just total lack of understanding of the subject matter. That's all. People may try to get out of it, but it's not going to happen. They just don't know what they're talking about. So technically, there's no need. But if one's done, it's not that it's wrong. It's not a problem. You know, just like people redo their vows, but it's not necessary. It's just sentiment. You know what I'm saying? Because the point is the connection. If they were bona fide time connected, then that they'll go into the things. No, but they weren't bona fide connection. If they fell down, they were never devotees. And that's all nonsense. Like that. Because if you're talking on that level, what you're meaning is they were never on the platform of prema. Because below prema, you can fall down. But Bharat Maharaj is not in the Bhagavatam because he's a bozo. But he fell down. And no one has a problem with it. And if you do have a problem with it, you're not qualified to read Bhagavatam. So that's why in the Kali Yuga especially, you have a founder acharya. Because the founder acharya is going to establish the teachings that will always work. And so if the Siksha Gurus follow, are loyal to the conclusions and instructions of the founder Acharya, you will go back to Godhead. That's just the way it is. That's Krishna's arranged it like that. And if you don't like it, you're also in the wrong, you know, you're in the wrong movement. You're in the wrong, try Shaivism or something. But I even think they expect some loyalty. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I just want to make one like comment that we, Prabhupada doesn't mention the Ritvik idea, and he doesn't mention the reinitiation idea.
No.
He doesn't.
No.
So, but we rule out the Ritvik idea, but we accept this idea.
The other one just kind of fall by the wayside. Now nobody worries about it. So if someone gets or doesn't get, but you know, on the bureaucratic platform they like to push it, but that's because bureaucrat means Shudra. So, by definition, that's what it is. Bureaucrat's not a leader. Leaders don't think like that. Bureaucrats do. Because they like one rule fits everybody at all situations. It makes it easy for them. Because bureaucrat can't handle the pressure of having to balance various incongruous elements to come out with a decision. That being a leader means this dynamic that you may have to adjust and change as you go. Bureaucracy just wants one thing, it's done, finished, now we can, you know, hari bal. But then 6 months later, then you come up with some completely insane thing that they have to sit and have another meeting and another resolution. Like that. It has nothing to do with reality, either on the spiritual or material platform. You understand? Leadership, that's an eternal principle. Bureaucracy, that's just an assistance to administration. It's not leadership. You understand? So, the point is that if devotees are comfortable with, if somebody really feels they need to, otherwise they don't feel that it's a clean start and all that, then if they get reinitiated, it's no problem. But it's just a matter of sentiment. But, you know, it works like that. But if they understand it's the siksha that's the real point of initiation, then they'll seek out siksha. Right? Because otherwise, then what'll happen is then, you know, then this one will have a problem or that one will have a problem. Why? Because they have a problem. They only see the guru as the external. So there's not the instructions that are important. You know what I'm saying? Otherwise, then why is it one has advanced so far anyway by following the instructions of the spiritual master. Those instructions can't be bad. Right? But the point is the relationship is supposed to be dynamic. So therefore, you're taking advantage. One may say, what? Prabhupada's disciples, they're not, you know, no, but they, if they're not taking shelter of the other devotees, the senior devotees, then they're also not, it's not going to be so dynamic.
One more question. If one falls down?
If one falls down.
Yes. The disciple falls down.
If the disciple falls down.
So then he can make it up for another initiation.
He can make it up for another, I'm not sure. I'm not catching the grammar here.
He loses his faith. Then he finds it later in somewhere else.
Or maybe he won't be the same.
The point is when you're dealing in the neophytes, all these things working with sentiment, as long as they're connecting themselves to bona fide gurus and they're not having more than one Diksha Guru at once, it basically works. But as far as, you know, direct and serious devotional understanding, it's unnecessary. You understand?
I was just remembering one example from Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj. I don't know if it's applicable.
So that's why you should start with that first.
No, it just came to my mind.
Oh, okay. Just
because it's not the initiation, but the sannyas. The sannyas, he fell down with his wife, and then Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj again gave him the sannyas.
So is that a problem? Prabhupada did that all the time.
I don't know.
We have God brothers that I think, you know, were reinstated like two or three times. Like that. The point is that it's an ashram from which you function. You understand? So, the point is, do you have, is there enough need to function in a grihastha environment? Does that make sense? That it would be worthwhile, therefore, to get married and to engage all those needs in Krishna's service, right? And when it's going smoothly, one's very comfortable. When it's not going smoothly, one's less comfortable, right? But one wouldn't want to be in another situation, right? So then you're supposed to be grihastha. If there's very minimal aspects like that, then one remains a brahmachari or one's a sannyasi. But it's not enough that one would be comfortable engaging oneself as a sannyasi or as a brahmachari, right? Does that make sense? But if something goes wrong, then it's a matter of, okay, now this has gone wrong. Now do you reassess it? Now do you feel you would more be comfortable now functioning as a grihastha? Because you've now seen that your desires are greater, they're actually more there. Or is that just something where one gets overwhelmed? And so, but one's actually, you know, would rather function in the celibate ashrams. So it's a matter of choice. Because the point is someone's going to act according to their nature. You can't act outside of that. So therefore, if that's there, that commitment's there, then they're put back in that position. But you have to see that they're strong. Therefore, Prabhupada would always give association. So the idea is to put them in that position or situation in which they can get that association, that they'll be strong to be able to come back to that. Right? Because the point is it's like this. The grihastha, you know, it means, because we look at this from, it's like only sannyasis or gurus fall down. You know, I'm sure if you took, you know, it's like, when was the last time the sannyasi went away? You know, it's now it's like every so many years. When Prabhupada was here, as many were made, took sannyas, that many left. There were always between 19 to 21 sannyasis at any one time during the 70s. There was never any more. But every year, 5, 6, 10, 12, were taking sannyas. So it's actually quite good now. But if you look at the list of householders falling down, you could probably come up with a good list of what's happening. Yeah, well, that's another thing where we're talking about, the point is that they're engaged outside their marriage or things like that. So it's not that that's any different. You know what I'm saying? But that's okay. Oh, they're already married, so if they're having extramarital affair, then it's not so bad. But the point is if it's an ashram where you're focusing your needs and connecting it to Krishna, how is this an advantage for the ashram? Right? The banker guy is authorized to work with money, so if he steals some of the money, it's not so bad, right? Yeah, so he's going to end up in the same place as the guy who walks in, pulls out a gun and says, hand me the money. Right? So, the point is that the grihastha falling down is no different. But we have this false conception that it's okay. It happens. We're just being practical. It's called the Yuga Prabhu. Well, we're only human. Right? But as this, the opening of this section is, everybody's only human. If you're not human, then most likely you're not in this movement. Right? At least you fit in the 400,000. We can broaden it to that much. Does that make sense? So the point is therefore, is this grihastha going to continue where he is now, right, in that situation, or is it going to be, he's going to continue as a grihastha, but another situation? Right? We may not like it. The guy ran off with, means he's working in the temple there, or he's, you know, whatever it is in the temple, and she's in the temple, and their families are in the temple, but he doesn't get along with his wife, and she doesn't get along with her husband, and all that. And so, you know, some point one of them talks to the other about it, because, you know, they're there, and they know each other, and that, and they get some solace and all that. But then with time, they find they get more solace from this other person than from their own partner. And then at one point, you just find out that both of them are gone, and they're not there anymore. And they're off, you know, and you know, you hear about them, they resurface in Zimbabwe, you know. Does that make sense? Now, what do you do? This is a nonsense, you know, you can't be a grihasta anymore, you've abused the privileges of being a grihasta, so therefore, you know, you can't be a grihasta. Right? No, they're best situated as a grihasta. But now do they go, now that was just a fling, they go back to their own marriages? Or was that something more solid and now they're going to carry on with that properly for the rest of their life? Because I've seen both. I've seen that they go off and this and that, and then after a couple of months they come back like a, you know, like a half-drowned rat, you know, that, oh, sorry, this and that, you know. And life goes on. You know what I'm saying? So the point is, it's still the point is, how do you situate yourself? Because when it's improper, then that's not any ashram. But they're either going to have to be in that ashram with their present spouse, or in the ashram with someone else. But the point is you have to make it work. It's not a matter of, oh, we can just go from one to the next, it doesn't matter. That's nonsense. Point is one person for the rest of your life. It's the same principle. You understand? The principle is the same. So therefore, the sannyasi, does he belong in that? Or was it just a fling? You know what I'm saying? Because if it's a fling, you go back to where you were. But if it's not a fling, then you go off with the new partner. Right? So the same. The sannyasi, if it was a fling, he goes back to being a sannyasi. If it wasn't, it was something serious, then he marries that person and carries on with that person. But you have to situate yourself in ashram properly. It's for spiritual upliftment. And as we mentioned here, there is no prayaschitta other than chanting Hare Krishna. Right? If there's no prayaschitta for the grihastha to run out, why would there be one for the sannyasa or the brahmachari? You know what I'm saying? And we see the prayaschitta is better association, better sadhana, better like that. That's what is prayaschitta. Anything else is simply pandering to the neophyte mind. That's all. Pandering means catering, yeah. Catering to the neophyte mentality. Which is very popular. That's why they call it vox populi. Vox populi means catering to the common. Because the actual Vedic mentality understands that there is no prayaschitta. So if there's a need to see a prayaschitta, that's common. That's the common person, because they only think in terms of physical. They're in this situation, you have to remove them from that, put them in another situation, because for them it's the situation that makes them happy. Right? But for someone in knowledge, the situation can be favorable, but it doesn't really have anything to do with it. You know, as any man who's been married for some time understands, he can create the perfect situation. It doesn't mean he'll get the perfect response, because it's all in mentality, not in situation. Right? Does that make sense? Is that okay?
I don't want to go so far out of the track, but maybe there is no prayaschitta, but there was also was a punishment for.
There was a punishment for.
Different kinds of this behavior.
There was a punishment.
There is.
It's not
performed in that kind of.
No, but I'm saying, when you say there is, what's your reference?
Like according to Manasana.
According to Manu, but what's Manu talking about?
I don't know specifically.
So if you don't know, why quote? Manu gives very specific material things that are done, then therefore there's reactions. Right? But that is for what's known, because the common person has a problem. But you can also, just by going and reveal that in an assembly of advanced persons at a yajna, and then after the yajna is finished, taking bath with them, then you're purified. There is no prayaschitta. Because what's going to happen at the yajna? These big Vedic yajnas, what do people do?
They chant mantras.
They chant mantras. They associate. Means the Mahabharata, the Bhagavatam, all the Puranas, all these were spoken at a yajna. Right? So in other words, it means by going to the yajna, associating with advanced personalities and hearing from them on spiritual subject matters, that's what purifies you. So after listing all the things that you do for, you know, you picked your nose in public, this is what happens. You picked your nose with the right finger, this is what happens. You picked it with the left finger, that's right. If you use the right finger in the left nostril, this is what happens. You know, all those different things. So then after that, then he mentions this. Does that make sense? So his point is, there's nothing more powerful than the chanting of the holy name. That's Manu's conclusion. Right? So studying of shastras, chanting the holy name, you know, following, there's nothing more strong and more powerful to remove sin. So the point is the repentance is that I shouldn't have done that, and then the determination is I won't do it again. Right? In other words, when I say that was bad, then one is purified. But one says, makes the determination, I'm not going to do this again, then one is fully purified. That's Manu. Right? No fingers were cut off. You missed the point.
No, I know what is the point.
So then why ask? Point is he mentions a lot of fingers getting cut off. But his conclusion is that's because the common person themselves doesn't think it's wrong or I won't do it again. It's just like this. The guy's a thief. He doesn't think it's wrong. He just, the bad thing is he got caught. Right? So therefore, if you cut off his fingers, then it's hard to steal. So anytime he wants to take things, he has to think about it. So then, hopefully, after lifetimes and lifetimes of this, he comes to the conclusion that stealing's not good. You lose too many fingers, right? You gain a lot, but you also lose a lot. You know, it's like, what's the use of stealing the diamond ring if you have no finger to put it on? Huh?
Makes sense.
Yeah, so that's what he's doing. And the common person, because, you know, gossip to them is like the most important thing of their life, right? So therefore, you know, you have to have some talk, oh, you did this, and oh, that happened, like that. Because otherwise, they do it themselves. You know what I'm saying? That's what we're dealing with. The Vaishnavs, you're dealing with the level that this person's done this wrong, and then they just see that's wrong, take up good association, again, situate themselves nicely in the devotional process, and move forward. Right? So for the Vaishnav, then it's like, okay, these things happen. I have to be more careful. Right? And they move forward. For the common person, it's like, well, he did that and got away with it. And then he came back and all he had to do was come back and chant. So therefore, I could do that also. Therefore, you have to use terms like eternal damnation and hell and cutting off fingers and that. Otherwise, they will do it. You know, because they're not going to look at, it's like this. How are they going to look at it? You know, the crowd comes along yelling and screaming and all this, and, you know, and then suddenly, you know, it comes around the corner and there's, you know, a wall there, and then some disheveled lady gets shoved at the wall and everyone's got their rocks, right? And so then you make the comment, well, you know, everybody, you know, I mean, definitely she had a bad hair day. You could just look at her hair. But so now, who's qualified to punish is someone who hasn't done. So therefore, right, and then they all go away. And then you could say, wow, she was an adulteress and she didn't get punished, so I could be an adulteress and not get punished. Is that what you'd learn from that? No, but that's what the common person does with that. Therefore, you have to use these terms like eternal damnation. There is no such thing as eternal damnation. It doesn't exist. You know, I mean, 100,000 years verse in Creamy Bojan being a worm and eating other worms and getting eaten by worms. It's a long time. It may seem eternal, just like the kid in the backseat of the car. Are we there yet? No, it's going to be 3 hours. Are we there yet? No, it's only been 5 seconds. Are we there yet? Shut up. You know, like that. You know, it seems like forever. But you're dealing with not a very mature level of consciousness. Therefore, you say eternal damnation. It's like, you know, like that. But the point is there is no such thing. You know, if we're saying God's all merciful, why would there be eternal damnation? You know, it's for the person who wants to do nonsense, but doesn't do nonsense, wants to make sure anybody who does do nonsense is going to be punished severely. That's what it's for. It's for the common person. Therefore, Manu explains how you deal so the common people are there, but he also deals for those who are superior to the common person, how they'll view it. And then he explains what's even beyond that. You know. Yes.
Somewhere Bhaktivinoda Thakur is written that maybe it's the Krishna Samhita or something, but he's saying that the hellish planets are imaginary or isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that's why it's said that the Krishna Samhita, he mentions that all other books are written for the Uttama or the Neophyte. So he's writing Krishna Samhita for the Madhyama. In other words, they're techniques of preaching. So if you take it and misunderstand it, then one wasn't an Uttama, let's say. Right? Because the point is we will take it by, the common person will take it by face value. So we want to avoid the common perspective. If I say it's imagination, what do I mean? For the common, uninformed Western mind. What does it mean? It doesn't exist. Right? But if you look at it from the Vedic perspective, imagination, where is it situated? Where is it performed? In the mind. So is the imaginary element, is it real or not?
Yes.
It means imagination is real. What you're imagining may not be, but the imagination is real. It's on the platform of the mind. Okay. Now, when the Yamadutas take this particular unfortunate living entity, then he doesn't have a gross body. He's only in the subtle body. But they cover the subtle body with a slight, special, very sturdy covering. So that you can be thrown off a mountain and, you know, dash, you know, basically what would kill you, but you don't die, right? And then they do that all day, and they do that for years, you know. They have great fun, these guys, right? So the point is it's happening on the mental platform. You're actually being thrown off the mountain, and you're actually hitting the jagged rocks on the bottom. But the soul, it actually hurting, it's not real. It's because we identify with, or we're in connection with, therefore we feel that. So it's actually imaginary, but it's there. But by saying that, we understand in our own philosophy what was meant. It was a very clever usage of wording that we understand the philosophy as it is, and the karmis will drop the point. Because for them, it's not... The important point is not whether hell is real or not, but it's a point that a big obstacle to stand in the way of them understanding devotional service. Therefore, he gives all these glib one-liners on just how you sideline. Have you ever seen like Jayadwaita Maharaj at a Rathayatra question and answer? It's just, you know, they come up with all these crazy things, just these one-liners, and bang, it's gone. Because it's not worth talking about. You know, it's like this one devotee in New York. You know, they were going to a house program, and you have there in most of the older areas, you have the building and then you have the sidewalk. And to get more space, you have the stairs outside, and that also allows for going down to the underground apartments. So that place there is called the stoop. And they, so they sit on the stoop. They sit on the stairs, right? It's technically considered inauspicious, but, you know, hey, that's where you... They're New Yorkers. So these devotees are going into this program. And there's this guy sitting there. And as the devotee goes by, then the guy on the steps goes, hey, what's with the bed sheets? Right? Because they're wearing dhotis and saris. And then the devotee turns to him and goes, that's because the blankets were dirty. They're being washed. And then the guy cracks up, and then they start a great relationship. Like that. So it's nothing to do with the bed sheets. It's just like, you know, what's going on? You know, what's the thing? Like that. So by getting, no, they're not bed sheets. So this, that's, you know, it's not the point. You know, so you just go beyond it, and then it's like, okay, cool. So that's what Bhakti Vinod is giving a whole book on how to do that. But he's doing it in such a way it doesn't affect the philosophy. Does that make sense? That's why it's a book only for the Madhyams. But one has to look at it from, because we're used to it. It's speaking, it's directly speaking the absolute truth, you know, like that. But here it's speaking the absolute truth, but through the medium of that environment in which the other person is going to be affected like that. Yeah, you know, you take, you know, Varnashram. No, but that's the caste system. So you have to have something that just sideline, because it's an issue. Issues, it doesn't matter how logical you are, how well presented, people won't drop issues. If they have a doubt, they'll drop it. But issues, they just won't drop. So how to deal with an issue that you can sideline it so you can deal with the real point, which is Krishna consciousness. That's what Krishna Samhita is.
So you're saying that the Krishna Samhita's preaching strategy in the Srimad Bhagavatam is...
That's what you're preaching. Right? What you preach is Bhagavatam, but when you run into obstacles because of their especially modern mundane perspective on you know, life and the world and culture, Krishna Samhita gives ways to overcome that. But it doesn't in any way detract from the philosophy. You know what I'm saying? So if it does, if devotees get confused by reading it, one, either they should understand it properly, you know, what it's for, or not read it. But that wasn't Krishna Samhita, that was the opening to the Bhagavad.
Okay. Bobhiel Kapoor once said, preaching is not always Siddhanta.
No, because you're using logic. But your point is you're speaking Siddhanta, but you're not necessarily using the standard Siddhantic terminologies and examples. But it's always Siddhanta. Also, you have to remember, is did he say that before... how do you say, January 1st, 1937, or after that? If it's before, it's valid. If it's after, Prabhupada said, don't even bother. OBL Kapoor, after, took up the Sahajya line along with Ananta Vasudev and Sundarananda Vidhi Vinod, that they made Ananta Vasudev into the world Acharya. And all that. So they disconnected themselves from the true line of Bhaktisiddhanta and became asar, or useless. So Prabhupada said anything he wrote before, you know, 1937, that is good. But anything after, it's not important. Like that. Because the point is it's not Siddhanta means you don't present it in direct Siddhanta. But if I go into some New Age thing, conference, and I'm talking about that, you know, the living entity, you know, is the life force, not the body. But that life force has an origin, it's the supreme. So that supreme life force that we should be cultivating, you know, the understanding of the relationship between us as life force and the supreme life force, right? Sounds perfectly New Agey, right? But that's direct Siddhanta of the soul, should know the Supreme Soul. I just changed the wording. You know, so giving him credit, then he's meaning you're not using the direct terms you would use when you're talking direct philosophy. But you can never not speak Siddhanta. Otherwise, what's the use? Why one would not speak Siddhanta? You know what I'm saying? It's an idea of this new soft preaching. But that's, personally, I'll just say it's because they don't actually know the philosophy well enough to speak it in their language and not lose it. Or it's that they know the philosophy well enough, but they don't know how to convert it. It'd be like let's say they're grammarians in their own language, but they don't know how to convert it into another language, so they can't communicate. But most of the time is they don't even know their own language, let alone another, and they're more impressed by this other touchy-feely kind of thing. Does that make sense? Is that okay? Yeah. So we'll end here.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samyavita Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi.